All right, we're going to look at the angelic world. We have done this in a study once before, but we're kind of marching through different themes and subjects. And when we began, and I want to see if we can do it tonight, to get back to our kind of our thrust, and that is the practicality of looking at the doctrine of angels, the angelic world, and what does this mean in practical terms to us? And so that question I want you to be able to answer or think about as we wind down the study tonight. So it's not just an academic study, which is important, but also has a good application to us today and where we are today. I want to start on the bottom because I want to talk about what Satan does. And remember, when we talk about the angelic world, there are two divisions. There is the holy angels, the righteous angels, and the fallen angels. And Satan is a fallen angel. He's the highest of the fallen angels. But I want to talk, let's start on some practical thoughts with the very last paragraph. What can he do to us? What can Satan do to us? Now, you've got to be careful because there are some on Christian radio and television who just go bonkers. You know, if your coffee cup falls on the floor, Satan did it. And they get real ridiculous. And they are kind of mystical, and they want something, some kind of mystical connection to everything that happens in this world. And while there are a lot that takes place is from Satan, there are many other things that you have to put into the mix to understand the nature of our world and what takes place with us. And by the way, interestingly, three of the things that on the bottom here that have to do how he deals with believers has to do with Peter. And most interesting. Let's take the first one at the bottom. Go to Luke 22 and verse 31. Luke 22, 31. I'm not going to get into all the context of all these passages, but let's just take a look at them. We are looking at Christ before his arrest, before going to the Garden of Gethsemane. And he has in mind the fact that Peter will deny him. And chapter 22 of Luke in verse 31. Simon, Simon, behold, Satan has demanded permission to sift you like wheat. But I have prayed for you that your faith may not fail. And you, when once you have turned again, that you turn back around, strengthen your brothers. That is, for what's going to happen to you, it'll turn out to be a blessing. It'll turn about that you will be able to then go back and speak with or encourage your brother disciples because of what's going to happen to you. Now, please notice the expression, sift you like wheat. I put down a note to tear you apart. That's what the sifting is, or the winnowing is throwing grain and separating the chaff from the grain, from the kernel. And so Satan demands is wanting to tear you apart. He wants to cause you to fly apart. And of course he will somehow not indwell Peter. And this is something I want to really thrust hard at tonight. The Bible never pictures believers being indwelt by demonic powers or by Satan. But he can influence. Now, how? And you might say, wait a minute, I can't see Satan operating on me. And how does he do that? Well, remember, his intelligence is far greater than ours. And he works within another realm, the spirit realm. So he doesn't indwell believers, but he can certainly manipulate, use, he can influence. And how he does that, I'm not sure. Now, this verse, verse 31, we might have to be a little careful because is he doing this to all believers, or is this a specific thing that Satan did because of Christ and then the coming arrest and crucifixion of Christ and the role that Peter will play? So could it be that this doesn't happen to everybody, but something very specific to the time of the Gospels when Christ was here? And it has to do with Peter. And I could toss a coin on that. Because sometimes we have to be careful to go from something that is specific to broad. We have to be careful of doing it. But it's interesting anyway to look at the passage and the power that Satan could have. And Christ said, I will pray for you that your faith may not fail. that is, and generally when that idea is given to the Bible, it means to fall flat and to almost cease. And his point is that Satan will be touched. Satan will have a moment of denial, but Satan will recover. In fact, I see Christ actually says that. When you have turned again, you will recover from this. Now go to 1 Peter chapter 5, another passage that has to do with Peter. Interesting that the verses that talk about what Satan or demonic powers can do to believers has to do with Peter. Most interesting. 1 Peter chapter 5, or at least it's mentioned. This is not about Peter, but it's very interesting that it's written in Peter's letter, Peter's epistle. Maybe I put it that need to put it that way. Satan wishes to destroy believers. And so I need to back up. This is not necessarily about Peter, but it is recorded by Peter. Look at chapter 5, 1 Peter, verse 7. Casting all your anxiety upon him because he cares for you. Be of sober spirit. Be on the alert. Your adversary, the devil, prowls about like a roaring lion, seeking someone to devour. But resist him firm. But resist him firm in your faith, knowing that the same experiences of suffering are being accomplished by your brothers who are in the world. Now, somehow Peter, in saying this, ties together the desire of Satan to devour other believers, us, other Christians. But he says then resist him, and knowing that the same experience of suffering is in other brothers. Now, is that suffering, does that have to do with general suffering? And that Satan would use the moment of general suffering to work on us, to come against us? Or is this suffering, verse 9, is that part of the work of Satan in coming up against us like a lion? Is that the suffering? Or when we do suffer, Satan takes advantage of it. So there's two ways maybe of looking at this. You and I suffer in the world and Satan takes advantage of it and tries to destroy us. Or the fact that he tries to destroy us is a suffering. And so there may be two ways to look at this. By the way, even though verse 9 says resist him, it does not say attack him. And you and I are not strong enough to attack Satan. And we've got a lot of folks in the charismatic movement, you know, drawing swords, and they're going to defeat Satan. They're going to do a swashbuckling sword fight with Satan. And the Bible doesn't say that. We resist, and I think part of that resistance is trust. Resist him, be firm in your faith. Firm in your trust. That's how you resist him. Now, he can't get inside of you, but he can place somehow attitudes before you, philosophies before you. He can manipulate other people, maybe, who come and discourage you. We don't know how. The Bible does not explain the multiple ways in which Satan can even sift, like in Luke, or here, come against us as a roaring lion. The Bible is not specific as to how. But it just tells us what our part is, and that is to resist and be firm in faith. And to know something, by the way, to know something. To know that we share experiences of suffering with other believers, whether that is a satanic attack or when we do suffer, Satan will take advantage of it. He will somehow attempt to use that to further weaken us. We could spend more time on this, and I'm not going to try to exegete all those two verses tonight in detail, and some of those questions are hard to answer. When you get into this whole area of how demons work and Satan works, even how the godly angels work, we're talking about another sphere. We're talking about another realm. And the Bible, therefore, can't be specific because you and I wouldn't get it. It's another whole nother arena that you and I do not exist in. But that other world is real. That is a real world. The world of the angelic hosts, whether they are good angels or evil angels. And Satan is an angel, by the way. So he's an angel, he's a spirit, and he's part of that. Go to 2 Corinthians 12. 2 Corinthians 12. And Whoops, I have got a typo there. 2 Corinthians 12, and I want to start, verse 7. 2 Corinthians 12, 7. The Apostle Paul says this, because of the surpassing greatness of the revelations that were given to Paul, how he was used of God as an apostle. For this reason, to keep me from exalting myself, there was given me a thorn in the flesh, a messenger of Satan, to buffet me, to beat me up, actually. Not just buffet like to hit with a feather, but to beat up. That term is used for a boxing match. To beat up on me, to keep me from exalting myself. Concerning this, I begged the Lord 3 times he would have it depart from me. He said to me, my grace is sufficient. For power, that is God's power, is perfected or matured by our human weakness. If we are weak, then we draw upon his power. Okay? If we think that we're strong, then guess what? We're going to be knocked down. But if we recognize our limitation, then his power will be matured or perfected. Most gladly, therefore, I'd rather boast about my weaknesses, that the power of Christ may dwell in me. Therefore, I am well content with weaknesses, with insults and distresses and persecutions and difficulties. For Christ's sake, when I am weak, then I am strong. I have to depend upon the Lord. But go back to verse 7 again. It was given to me. And I think that this is given by God, because God gave him this thorn in the flesh in order to humble him. Because he was given all this revelation, it could have gone to Paul's head. And he said, I needed this to keep me humble so that God could work in me. But he calls what God put upon him a messenger of Satan to beat me up. Now, is Paul using what we'd call an illustration, exaggeration, or hyperbole? Or actually what God gave him was Satan, a messenger from Satan. As the thorn became a messenger from Satan to beat Paul up. In other words, was Satan involved in this, or is this kind of just an exaggerated thought? I would lean on the fact that Satan is somehow involved in this. And it may go back to the story of Job, where God gave Job permission, or pardon me, Satan permission. He gave Satan permission to take certain things away from Job in order to test him. And so the same thing here. God did something in order to allow Satan to beat up on Paul, but the result would be that Paul would stay humble and God's power would be exercised in the Apostle Paul. So again, my question, is this verse 7, is this just to Paul, or could we apply it to us? I think we could apply it to us. Now you say, well, why one over the other? Well, because God can use things in order to humble us. That idea is a general idea. As Paul needed humbling, you and I need humbling. And God can give us things that somehow we don't understand it, can't figure it out. Satan is involved in it. God is giving permission. And yet it comes out to be for our strength. Now, what are those things? I believe, and almost every scholar I know would say that this is Paul's eye problems. That he was given eye problems because when he saw the Lord on the road to Damascus, he was blinded, and that remained with him. That stigma remained with him. And he begged God 3 times to take it away. And God says, no, I'm going to leave it with you. And somehow, that becomes something that Satan is involved in, and God uses it and turns it so that Paul becomes stronger inside, and he doesn't puff himself up. He is kept humble. Again, we're into some areas that we have trouble being very specific. We can all guess, and maybe there's as many ideas in the room as there are folks sitting here, because is it applied only to Peter and Paul? Is this specific? Can we say this could be for us today? We don't have a lot of illustrations of how Satan comes against believers. I'm giving you the ones that the Bible would give to us. Go to Matthew 16 and verse 23. We're getting close to running out on them right now in terms of specific what Satan can do to us or will do to us. Matthew 16, verse 23. And another deal with Peter. Peter said in verse 22, he took Christ aside, began to rebuke him, saying, "God forbid." Of course, he's talking about the death of Christ. Christ was predicting his death. And Peter says, "God forbid, Lord, this shall never happen to you. I won't let it happen." Well, that sounds good. He's trying to defend Christ. He wants to protect him. Sounds good to me. Well, look what the Lord said, verse 23. He turned and said to Peter, "Get behind me, Satan. You're a stumbling block to me. You're not setting your mind on God's interests, but man's interests." That is profound. You and I don't see things as God sees them. You and I don't measure things as God measures. You and I don't know the repercussion of what I say or do today and what that means for tomorrow. You and I don't know what we're saying sometimes. You and I are so limited. Now, again, would this be something that the principle here, that you and I open our mouth and we speak amiss and we're speaking the thoughts of Satan? Very possible. But again, is this specific because it's dealing with a key apostle and Christ before his death, burial, resurrection? I kind of lean toward that on this one. Now, does this mean that Peter was indwelt? No, I don't think so. But he's saying what Satan would have loved to have said. I don't want Christ to go to the cross. Satan did not want Christ to go to the cross. He would therefore be the Redeemer. And therefore he would be obedient to the Father, by which the Father will then turn around and give him the kingdoms of this world. Christ is yet to take the throne over all of history, but he's going to do that because he was obedient even to the death of the cross. And Satan hates that. Satan would have loved to have stopped the cross. And somehow Peter was saying the thoughts of Satan here. And I don't think he's been dwelt, but he's saying the very thoughts of Satan. Now, the book of Job. Go to Job chapter 1. We find a very interesting story in that the book of Job in chapter 1 gives us a heavenly viewpoint in which Satan comes before God. And the question is, righteous Job, does he follow God, obey God, because he's internally a righteous man 100%? Or is he doing it because God blesses him? This is the question. In fact, let's take a look at a couple of quick verses there in Job chapter 1. Another question comes up. I thought that Satan was cast from heaven. And here in Job, we find Satan coming before God. I think the differentiation is that Satan was cast from heaven in terms of his when he decided to be like God. That was part of the accusation. When he decided to be like God, to take God's power and authority, he was cast from heaven, but in terms of fellowship with God. Remember, Satan was the archangel. He was the number one angel of all the angelic beings. And his desire was to be like God. And in terms of relationship fellowship, he was tossed out from the presence of God. Though Satan can come before God and make accusations, but not in terms of relationship. He no longer has fellowship with God. He is doomed in his role. But he can come before God's throne room, if you will, and make accusation. That's the story we have here in the book of Job. But look into verse 9 of chapter 1 of Job. Satan answered the Lord, "Does Job fear God for nothing? Have you not made a hedge around him, his house and all that he has on every side? You've blessed the work of his hands. His possessions have increased in the land. But God," now Satan speaking to God, "put forth your hand and touch him and all for all that he has, and surely he will curse you to your face." And the Lord said to Satan, "Behold, all that he has is in your power. only do not put forth your hand on him, that is to totally destroy him. The thought is to completely destroy him. So Satan departed from the presence of the Lord, and then he will have the power to manipulate certain earthly things around and concerning Job. I don't understand that. Does he continually have that power, or is he given that power specifically in this encounter concerning Job? And again, I could argue both ways. We could go two different directions on that. But the point is, he would have power to do things around and concerning Job. He could not completely destroy Job, but he could, and he did. He was instrumental in having all kinds of things removed from Job. However, very interesting. Yesterday we talked about the sovereignty of God in Romans 9. Go to chapter 42 of Job, and what is the comment as we come down to the end of Job about this work of Satan on Job? What's the summary of it? Look at Job 42:10. The Lord restored the fortunes of Job, when he prayed for his friends, and the Lord increased all that Job had twofold. Then all his brothers, his sisters, and all who had known him before came to him, and they ate bread with him in his house, and they considered him and comforted him for all the evil that the Lord had brought on him. Now look up here a second. Satan is a powerful being. We're going to look at some more verses tonight and see how powerful he is. He is a real being. And he is at work in this world 24/7, okay? But the point of these verses is that, guess what? Satan can't choose, spit, or stand without God, because God is over even Satan. And so the book almost bypasses, these last verses bypasses Satan, comes straight to God, and God's providence was involved in this whole story with Satan and the whole thing. I don't understand that. The work of Satan is bypassed. The evil that God put upon Job. Whoa. Remember, we said yesterday morning, God is not the author of evil, but he can manipulate evil. He can use evil for his purposes. Can you and I figure that out? Well, let's go have some banana pudding, because we ain't going to figure that out. You and I cannot figure that out. But this is the way it is. There is so much. You know, we're going to find out someday in glory how small we really are. How tiny we really are. And that we are in a vast universe. And behind the scenes, there are layers of beings in divisions and in armies of the angelic world, principalities and powers and dominions, Paul says, that you and I don't see. And there's a war in heaven. There's an ongoing conflict between the satanic powers and the angelic world. There's an ongoing conflict. And it filters down, it touches earth. It touches us down here. And how that's done, I can't say. But it does. It's happening. All right, now go back to the top of the sheet. And that's where we should have started, but I wanted to do that. Now, before we even go to the top, I want a couple of the verses that I did not put on the sheet. I want to go to those first. Go to Ephesians chapter 1. Ephesians chapter 1. Yes, Ronnie?
Right there in Job 1:6, it says angels came to present themselves before the Lord. They had to answer to him.
Yes, it's more than just Satan coming before the Lord. Apparently there are times in which God held court with the angelic world, and they come up before God and speak with him and discuss things with him. See, there's a lot happening in this world that you and I just don't see in this universe, in the other realm, the things that you and I just don't see going on. And thank you for pointing that out to me. Go to Ephesians chapter 1. Ephesians chapter 1, and whoops, I just took a wrong reference. Ephesians chapter. That's not the right reference. I'm sorry, chapter 2. Ephesians 2, verse 1. The Apostle Paul says that you were dead in your trespasses and sins, in which you formerly walked, talking about us as unbelievers, according to the course of this world. There is a world course. There is a world philosophy. There's a philosophy that drives the whole world. And you and I, before we became saved, we walked according to that philosophy, that course. According to the prince of the power of the air. And I believe that's without doubt Satan. When he said, I've always tried to figure out what does he mean, power of the air, the prince of the power of the air. You and I cannot see the philosophies and the thoughts that we can't. You and I cannot see a philosophy. You and I cannot see. We can see the results of evil. We can see people doing evil things, but we cannot see that. We cannot see a bowl of evil or 5 pounds of evil. But there's a whole. And when he says prince of the power of the air, you and I can't see air. And I think that's what he's talking about. The philosophies that you cannot see, but they are driving the universe or driving the world. There are philosophies that are at work in the world. We can't see those philosophies, but they're affecting people, nations, and so forth. So Satan is the prince of the power of the air. Like you and I cannot see air. We can see the results of air when the wind blows or whatever. And it's the philosophies that drive the world. And Satan is behind those philosophies. He is the prince of the power of the air, of the spirit. Now here Satan is called a spirit. That's now working in the sons of disobedience. Satan is working in. He's not indwelling necessarily. He is not indwelling. Though his demons can indwell people. But I'm not sure that Satan is going around dwelling in one individual. He's not omnipresent. There's only one Satan. And he's not omnipresent. But he goes on. He's the spirit that's working in the sons of disobedience. Among them we all too formerly lived in the lusts of our flesh. Guess what? We were part of that system. You and I were part of the system that's driven by Satan. All right, turn your television on tonight. Guess what? You're going to see the trashiest of the trash. And you say, what's going on? That's being driven by Satan. Satan is manipulating, driving, planting seeds, planting philosophies, planting attitudes into people that's causing people to do evil. We also walked in that same thing, indulging in the desires of the flesh and of the mind, and were by nature children of wrath as others. By nature, children of wrath. A bird can't write a book. I can't fly. We have different natures, and the lost person is by nature a child of wrath. A lost person is by nature a child of wrath. And you and I were part of that system. We were part of that system until we were saved. And God redeemed us out of the system. By the way, notice something in verse 3. Going back to verse 2, he's prince of the power of the air. You can't see these forces and philosophies that's driving the world. But it comes out, in my opinion, verse 3, in the physical. It manifests itself in the flesh and the desires of the flesh and the mind. And so when you see evil, wherever you see evil is just running rampant, it's coming out. That is the sin that Satan is promoting is coming out through the flesh. It's coming out in the works and the thoughts of human beings. All right, look at 2 Corinthians 4:4. 2 Corinthians 4:4. And we read this. These are several verses I thought about after I'd written the little notes. Paul says in 2 Corinthians 4:4, the God of this world, it'll be Satan, he's the God of this world, he has blinded the minds of the unbelieving. He has blinded the minds of the unbelieving. I teach total depravity. People are totally depraved. Their minds are blinded. They cannot see. They cannot see truth. They cannot comprehend truth. The minds are blinded by the god of this world, Satan. And so when you see all the crud, just flip the television on, watch a few commercials tonight when you get home, and you'll see. I've seen some things. I can't believe it. I can't believe the commercials, what some of them are about now. You say, that's terrible. But that's driven by the god of this world. Now be careful. God, the god of the universe, this is his world. He has a plan going for this world. Satan, as the god of this world, Satan isn't controlling the trees, the birds, the bees, the fleas. Satan is controlling the evil of this world. That's how he's the god of this world. He's controlling the evilness of this world. Not the globe, not the equator, north, south poles, but the issue of the sinfulness that has gripped humanity. Satan is in charge of that. He is the god of this world. Now go to the top of the sheet, and let's talk about the fall. The fall of Satan. And go to Isaiah chapter 14. In Isaiah 14 and also Ezekiel 28, there are two poetic passages of Scripture. They're poetic in the way that they're written. And they give to us an outline of the fall of Satan. And I don't know any Bible teacher that would disagree with that. There's some who, the liberals, don't like that idea from this passage, but I believe that it only makes sense. In chapter 14 of Isaiah, Isaiah is giving a judgment against Babylon. And suddenly, in verse 12 of Isaiah 14, you realize, wait a minute, he's not talking about the king of Babylon anymore. He's talking about something else. Isaiah 14:12, "How have you fallen from heaven, O star of the morning, son of the dawn?" And I'm not going to take time to exegete every piece of this poem, because it's in poetic language. "How have you fallen from heaven?" Now, wait a minute. The king of Babylon didn't fall from heaven. We're suddenly talking about another person. We're talking about a heavenly person. And apparently, this heavenly being is behind the king of Babylon. He's manipulating the king of Babylon. "How are you fallen from heaven, O star of the morning and son of the dawn? You have been cut down to the earth. You have weakened the nations. You have said in your heart," now here come the five eyes, "I will ascend to heaven. I will raise my throne above the stars of God." And most believe the stars of God is an illustration of the angelic beings in heaven at that time. The multitude of angels, the stars of God in heaven. I will sit on the mount of the assembly in the recesses of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will make myself like the Most High. Nevertheless, you'll be thrust down to the ground, down to the grave, to the recesses of the pit. Now, we go on to read the rest of it, and some of it, it's hard to grasp what it's talking about. But without doubt, we're talking about a heavenly being who is tossed from heaven, who wants to raise his throne above the stars of God, and I think that would be the angelic host of heaven. He wants to exalt himself above the other angels. And then he literally wants to make himself like the Most High. This would fit Satan. And Satan is behind the king of Babylon. Now this is a strange short passage of Scripture. It comes on these pages. It suddenly goes off. But it's trying to explain the power behind the king of Babylon. Now go to Ezekiel 28. And it's the fall of Satan. Ezekiel 28 has something similar. Ezekiel 28 and verse 11. Who is behind the king of Tyre? That's what's going on in Ezekiel 28, the king of Tyre. And suddenly, in verse 12, we're no longer talking about the king of Tyre. start at 11. Again, the word of the Lord came to me saying, Son of man, take up a lamentation over the king of Tyre and say to him, Thus says the Lord God, you had the seal of perfection. You were full of wisdom and perfect in beauty, an earthly king, known as the king of Tyre. And again, most would say, we're no longer talking about the king of Tyre. We're talking about a power behind the human king of Tyre. You were in Eden, the garden of God. Was the king of Tyre in Eden? No. Every precious stone was your covering. The ruby, topaz, diamond, beryl, onyx, jasper, lapis lazuli, turquoise, emerald. All of this was the clothing of this personality who had been in the Garden of Eden. Look at the last part of verse 13. On the day that you were created, they were prepared, this clothing. You were the anointed cherub who covered, and I placed you there, and you were on the holy mountain of God, and you walked in the midst of the stones of fire. You were blameless in your ways from the day that you were created until unrighteousness was found in you. Unrighteousness was found in this personality. And so again, there's some language here that's poetic, and I don't take time to try to explain each little piece, but you get the big picture. We're not talking about the king of Tyre anymore. We're talking about a being who was in the garden, that would be Satan, who was the most beautifully adorned personality. If he was an angelic being, he was created. He was created. He is called the anointed cherub. He was on the holy mountain of God, in the presence of God. He was found blameless until unrighteousness was found in him. He was blameless. So we have two passages of Scripture that would give us some far distant descriptions of Satan before and at the point of his fall, his demise from the presence of God. Unrighteousness was found in him. He desired to be like God, and he was cast from the presence of God in his fellowshipping with God. Now go to Revelation chapter 12. Because there's one more passage about this fall, I believe. Some of my friends think Revelation 12 is actually taking place in the middle of the tribulation. I do not. I think it's a summary of the career of Satan. That is part of this. Part of this is the summary of the career of Satan. Look at verse 4. Revelation 12, 4. This being, this dragon... And he says in verse 3, the dragon, and by the way, he's called the dragon. In this passage, he's called the dragon, he's called Satan, and the serpent. In verse 9, he's called the dragon and Satan, the serpent. Mercy, hold it. Verse 9, he's called the dragon, the serpent, the devil, and Satan. Four descriptions in one verse. So guess who we're talking about. All right, now go to verse 4. His tail swept away a third of the stars of heaven and threw them on the earth. When Satan fell, he took a third of the angels with him. They joined him in his conspiracy against God. This would be the satanic, this would be the demonic world. They fell with Satan and fell to the earth. Now, by the way, in the rest of verse 4, John picks up and says, what is the result of the fall of Satan? Guess what the result is? He is pursuing the woman who is Israel. He's trying now to destroy Israel. And that has been an ongoing activity of Satan since the nation of Israel was formed. And then he talks about the child in verse 4, that would be Christ. He seeks to destroy the child who would come forth from the woman who is Israel in chapter 12 of Revelation. All right, let's summarize. He was a heavenly being. He was the most powerful cherub. When he fell, he took, if this passage is talking about eternity past, a third of the angels of heaven, the stars of heaven with him. He wanted to be like God. He fell to the earth and destroyed the nations affected the nations when he came to the earth. All right, now let's pick up. And now let's stop right here, see if you've got any questions at this point, because we're kind of moving fast. Yes, Ron?
It's not a question, but I think we just need to let kind of sink in a little bit a couple of facts about that. I mean, you know, the fact that he's an angel, we just kind of say that and brush by. And the fact that he was created being, that we just kind of brush by, because we tend to equate, I think, in normal, just thinking about it, we tend to think of him being kind of like God.
No way.
No,
he's not. No way. He's not. No.
So he was, you know, the fact that he was created.
Yeah.
And the fact that he is just an angel.
Right.
Now, I say just an angel. Of course, the angels are more powerful and more knowledgeable.
Right, right.
But, I mean, still, I find that we don't let that sink in our thought process.
I think you're right. And I think on that point, we do need to keep remembering that God is still more powerful. He is Satan is a created being, but sometimes Christians give him too much authority. That is, we almost begin to fear Satan. There should be a respect that he is not stupid, that he knows what he's doing, he has a plan himself, but at the same time, our trust and our faith is in God. And a lot of Christians, you know, they're out, you know, with broomsticks fighting Satan. But Satan is a real being. He has power. He has authority. He hates God. He hates believers. He hates Israel. But his demise is coming. And he knows it. He can read the Bible as well as we can. He knows it. His demise. But it doesn't matter. He still is marching straight on to perform evil against God, against God's people. And he is real. But there's two truths here. And Ron's talking about that in the sense that he's a created being, yes. He's a powerful being, yes. But we don't have to fear him, and that's in one sense.
Is that we think about Satan as being the opposite of God. He's not. He's just a created. He's not the opposite of God.
Yeah, in that sense, right. That's maybe Ron's point. He's not just the opposite of God. He's not another God. He's a created being. But he is very powerful. He was the most powerful of the angelic world, the ultimate, the most powerful. But he is not—he's not another God in that sense. Even though he's called a God of this world, he's not equal to the God of Scripture. All right, look at the next line that we have up here.
Can I make one more point?
Uh-huh, sure, go ahead.
I think when we were looking at Ephesians, you know, Ephesians 2, I think about... so I'll just share this. I think about Ephesians 6:12 also. And that our it says our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the powers, against the world forces of this darkness,
right,
against the spiritual forces of wickedness in the heavenly places.
Yes.
And our struggle, you know, when we put on the full armor of God, I think back about the point you made about how Christians want to tend to go battle Satan.
Right.
When we're going to lose, I mean, we're just ourselves, you know. So we have to, the full armor. When we do it, and I think about how Peter is to stand firm in the faith, even though it's going to be sifted. God, Jesus prayed for him to stand firm in the faith, and then in 1 Peter 5:8, it says, you know, stand in the faith. You know,
right.
Resist him by standing
right.
in the faith, and that's what we have to do as Christians when we're in this battle. It's not us against him. I mean, we can't battle the heavenly battles in reality.
Right.
But we are to stand firm in our faith. And I think sometimes I might think of that as the full armor. It's what we've been given by the Lord so that we can, in fact, resist him and stand firm in our faith. Because the battle is not.
Right. Yeah, the resistance is standing firm, because you and I cannot win a conflict with him, but it's standing firm, and the scriptures is part of it, our trust in God, and so we can't see. We see the results of Satan working on the world, but we don't see him, and so we're dealing with a powerful being who how many hosts of fallen angels does he have at his command? Could be millions and trillions. We don't know. We don't know. The Bible doesn't tell us. But he has a tremendous influence, and he's controlling this world. But we should not fear. In the way, we should have a respect, and we should say, God, I trust you. I trust you, and I'm not going to run around trying to do battle with Satan. Yeah, Larry?
Well, if we rebuke him, some part says, get thee behind me, Satan. Is he obeying us at that point?
If we rebuke him, we're doing it in the name of the Lord. It's not in my power. I don't have the power to cause Satan to do what I want him to do. I, as a child of God, I can rebuke. I can say, you're not going to have control of me. But still, we're not at war with him. In that sense, we cannot defeat him. We can't defeat him. He's too powerful of a being. Yes. Well, he overcame the same by quoting the scriptures.
That's right.
He quoted the scriptures to him.
Right.
Right.
His trust was in the Lord.
Right, right.
So that's all we can do.
That's all we can do. That's right. That's right. But again, you know, one of the biggest things, and I hope you get out of this tonight, is to understand what's wrong with the world. What's wrong with the world? Now, people have their own sins. No one will stand before the judgment and say, well, you know, I'm a sinner because Satan made me do it. People have their own sins, but why the stirring? Why the anxiety? Why the chewing and the gnashing of the world and the restlessness that goes on and on and on of this world? It's not simply human. It is coming from Satan, who stirs and tries to destroy and tries to keep the gospel hidden, keep the truth covered. He hates the truth. He hates Israel. He hates the scriptures. He hates Christ. He hates us. But God will not let him destroy us, but he can have an effect upon us. He can be a roaring lion to destroy us, not to get rid of us, but to cause great woe in our life. How does he do that? I don't know. But what we have to do is, as Ron well put, we have to have trust. God, I trust you. I cannot do battle with Satan. I'm not stronger than he. I shall trust you. All right. Go ahead.
If he had his way with Job, more or less, do you reckon God allows it to happen to us also?
Well, yeah, I think so. I think so. I think that without question, because God's not helpless. If he knows that Satan is coming against me to trip me up, God isn't helpless, and he can stop it or not stop it. And in the case of Peter, in the case of Paul, they ended up being stronger by whatever came against them, by recovering from that, or by putting up with it. In the case of Paul, he said, I prayed three times, and God said, I'm not going to take it away. And his God's strength is there by trust. If we trust him, his grace and mercy is there. So God may allow in order to cause us to be exercised, to be stretched, and to be stronger. Absolutely. All right, look at the next point. And both the fallen angels, the good angels, and the bad angels are described as principalities, powers, and dominions. And there's about 8 references to that. I just want to go to one, Ephesians 1:21. Yeah, 1:21. Sorry, verse 20, Ephesians 1:20. What God brought about in Christ when he raised him from the dead, seated him at his right hand in the heavenly places. And by the way, that's the most mentioned verse from the Old Testament, Psalm 110:1. He is seated at the right hand of the Father, far above all rule, authority, power, and dominions. And dominion, that little couplet or triplet is used over and over again to describe the angelic world. They have rule, authority, power, dominion. There is order, principalities. There is order in the ranking of the angelic host, whether it's the good angels or the fallen angels. They are ranks upon ranks upon angelic beings who have position in their ranks. There's a war going on between the good angels and the bad angels. The two classifications, the godly angels. Look at Revelation chapter 5. Revelation chapter 5. There are the godly angels are the ones who did not fall with Satan. Revelation 5:11. Just one illustration. 5:11, John said, I looked and heard the voice of many angels around the throne and the living creatures. They are angelic beings as well. So there are angels, general angels, living creatures, and there are specific living creatures described in Revelation who are doing special work for God. They're special angels. Angels, living creatures, and the 24 elders. And the number of them was myriads of myriads and thousands of thousands. Now, that's not describing the elders, only 24 elders in Revelation. But the living creatures and the angels, myriads and myriads and thousands of thousands. And most commentators say that's almost uncountable. And certainly millions of millions of angelic beings, innumerable, uncountable. And by the way, look what they're saying, what the godly angels are saying, the good angels, verse 12, saying with a loud voice, worthy is the Lamb that was slain to receive power and riches and wisdom and might and honor and glory and blessing. By the way, what's it mean when it says that to receive, whether it's to God or to Christ? That means that you and I are to say back to Him, you have all power. You control all riches. You are the stream of all wisdom. You have all might. All honor belongs to you and not to us. All glory is found in you. And all blessing comes from you. In other words, that we're giving those back to Him. We're describing Him that way. He deserves that kind of accolade from us. We give it back to the Lord because that's who He is. All right, go to Matthew 25. And verse 31, 25:31. Here there, the angels who did not fall are called the holy angels. They did not fall. They did not rebel with Satan. When the Son of Man comes in His glory, and the angels and all the angels with Him, then He will sit on His glorious throne. Missed my verse here. Whoops. I'm sorry. That's it. Whoops. No, that doesn't say the holy angels. I missed my verse. There's a verse that speaks of the holy angels. I thought that was the verse. That's not it. All right. There is a passage that speaks of the angels being the holy angels. This is an interesting verse that I landed on, by the way. When Christ comes back, He will come in His glory, and the angels will come with Him. And He will sit on earth. This is His earthly coming. He will sit on His glorious throne on earth, and the nations will be gathered before Him. Anybody find the, I'll give you an extra bowl of banana pudding, if you can find the verse that speaks of the angels as holy angels, because I misreferenced that. Go to 1 Timothy 5. 1 Timothy 5. And in chapter 21. They are called, the good angels are called the chosen or elect angels. 1 Timothy 5:21, I solemnly charge you in the presence of God, in the presence of Christ Jesus, in the presence of His elect or chosen angels. These are the angels that did not fall with Satan. These are the good angels. To maintain these principles that He spelled out in the verses before. Isn't that interesting that God the Father and Christ and the angels are witnesses that we are to maintain the principles that Paul has laid out in this book, especially the verses just before. They are the witnesses that we live out these principles. God the Father is looking at us. God the Son is looking at us. The angels, the elect, chosen angels are looking at us. Will we maintain the principles that Paul speaks about in terms of the Christian life? All right, go to Hebrews, and with this we'll stop and ask some questions and take a break. Hebrews chapter 2, the angels helped give the scriptures. We could go to a lot of verses on that. But in chapter 2 of the book of Hebrews, starting at verse 1, he is comparing the law, which was given by Moses, For this reason, we pay much closer attention to that which we have heard, lest we drift away from it. For if the words spoken through angels proved unalterable, and he's talking about the law was given by angels to Moses, who then recorded it. The law came down through angels, and it was unalterable. In other words, it can't be changed. What the angels gave to Moses, he recorded. This is the Mosaic law. And every transgression and disobedience receives a just recompense concerning the law. Verse 3, then how shall we escape if we neglect so great a salvation, which was spoken at first through the Lord? It was confirmed to us by those who heard. Here's his point. If we are to keep the law, which was passed down by angels, how much more we are to listen to the gospel and the way of salvation which comes through the Lord? How much more? The angels gave the law to and through Moses. That's what he's talking about. That's his context. Then how shall we escape salvation because of what the Lord spoke, giving the gospel? And that what he spoke was confirmed to us by those who heard what he said. And so if we could listen to the law given to angels down to Moses, how much more the gospel that Christ spoke and was witnessed by those who heard him. So they were involved somehow in the transmission of the Mosaic covenant. All right, let's stop right here and see if you have any questions or any points that you want to ask up to this point.
One fourteen of Hebrews.
Yes, I was going to come to that a while ago, but we're right there right now. Are they not ministering spirits? Here they're called spirits. Sent out to render service for the sake of those who inherit salvation. They somehow benefit and do things for us. Now what? I don't know. He didn't say. And be careful that you don't start speculating, trying to figure that out. I'm not sure. But they're ministering spirits to us who have received salvation. You see, we're talking about beings that we can't see, we can't touch. But they're ministering spirits. They do things on our behalf for the Lord. By the way, the definition of the word angel means messenger, Old Testament, New Testament. They are messengers of God. They are serving his purpose. He doesn't need messengers. God doesn't need messengers. But he has designed to use a whole host of messengers, angels, to perform his work. And here, they minister to us. How? I don't know. Not sure.
Didn't do it to me one night. Absolutely, God did it.
It could have been enchiladas.
No, it wasn't. I was in Hawaii. You don't eat enchiladas in Hawaii.
All right, any other questions? Anything else? All right, let's take a break, and please eat up a bunch of banana pudding, okay? All right.
Did you make it?